You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome. This is the Parish Council, the podcast from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Magnus Shaw, and Tagfly, Bosswock, Jam Nitty Gritty, you're listening to the boy from the Big Bag City. He's Terence Stickon.
Hello, Magnus.
Hello.
I'd just like to announce to everybody that I am foregoing my bonus this year. Following the example of Bob Diamond, I am going to forego it because of the issues that have happened and the whole LIBOR experience. So I won't need to have that bonus.
Well, if you're actually following to the very letter the lesson of Bob Diamond, you'd only forego your smaller bonus and hold on to the bigger one.
Apparently so. I read that today as well, yes. It's a game, isn't it? It's a right old laugh.
Yeah.
It's legalised mugging, isn't it? Banks really are kind of highwaymen, modern age highwaymen.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it does rather defy all logic. And it seems to all sort of happen on a different planet or in a different dimension where the same rules that apply to us don't apply.
Apparently not, no. And, far be it from me to bring any form of political edge to this, but at the time of recording, Mr. Diamond is still in his job. I just got a little message. Resign. That's it. That's my message.
Yeah. And I know he listens to the parish council almost religiously, so that will definitely get to him.
Now, Magnus Shaw, I've got a bit of an update for you. What would it be at the start of one of these podcasts in recent weeks if I didn't give you news of the sale of Beach Boys tickets for their one-off gig at Wembley?
Yes, fantastic. I think somebody was asking at the midway point between the last podcast and this one for an update. It was like the Tuesday used to be the midweek chart, didn't it?
Yes. Let me soothe the brow of anybody worried and in dire need of an update on the Beach Boys tickets, because I've got a bit of extra news this week, because the actual seats we've been monitoring, which are block A4 row 1ST,
yes,
remain at £474 each. Right. They haven't been sold. Mm-hmm. By the way, there are some more tickets available currently at £599. But I've got a bit of an extra twist to the news this week, because I've discovered something else.
Right.
Obviously, it's a volatile market. It's a secondary market. So through Seatwave, the price of these tickets go up and down. Well, whenever the sellers wish to update them.
Yeah.
They'll, as we talked about before, they'll try and get what they can. Mm. Now, one thing I hadn't really researched into before, and we'll just look at other tickets we've been tracking, which is Block A4, Row 1ST, currently £474 each. Not surprisingly, in today's world, there's a booking fee to go with this. Now, bear in mind that these two particular tickets are available on Seatwave's fast delivery process, which means you can download and print the tickets from your Seatwave account if you have one. So they're actually, there's no delivery charges, there's no postal charges, let us say. So you would think with these tickets at £474, if there has to be a booking fee, you know what's going to be coming here, don't you? But you'll still, it is eye-watering what I'm going to tell you.
Yeah.
Because, unbelievably, Seatwave, even if they were going to post these seats, but they're not, they're downloadable, whether one was paying £5 or £474, the booking costs, the booking fee, surely would be the same, because the process is still the same, isn't it? Whether somebody's actually got to put two tickets in an envelope and frank the envelope and put it in a letterbox or have it collected or whatever, is the same whatever the cost of the tickets.
Yeah.
Similarly, if I'm downloading the tickets, the administrative costs at their ends are the same, probably
50p ticket costs the same to post as a 50 grand ticket, yes.
Exactly, yeah. Magnus Shaw. So for these £474 tickets, the booking fee on anybody can look this up on Seatwave.com's official site. Yeah. Booking fee, £85.32.
Well, no way.
I am deadly serious. £85.32. Now that seems such an arbitrary figure that what I then checked on is that then I thought, well, this can't be this. You know, obviously, if you're buying a £20 ticket, you're not going to pay £85.
No.
They actually work it out on a percentage basis. So your booking fee is a percentage, and £85.32, I just had my calculator to play here, 18%.
Isn't
that outrageous?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, has Bob Diamond got anything to do with these Beach Boys tickets?
It must be part of the LIBOR market, doesn't it? So, but there's still yet a further little twist. So, £474 plus your 18% booking fee of £85 takes the total to £559.32. But then, just under this box, and I haven't gone further with this, it says you pay £559.32. Then it's got plus delivery. So there's not only a booking fee, there's a delivery fee as well.
That doesn't, in a way, doesn't surprise me that there's a delivery charge as well, because this is the whole deal with a booking fee, is that it doesn't appear to be for any tangible service whatsoever.
What's it all about? It's just a pernicious add-on that, again, like we were saying earlier with the whole Barclays debacle, they do it because they get away with it. There's no justification for it.
No.
And as we've mentioned before, we know we had that expose on TV some 6 months or nine months ago, a year ago or something, of the secondary ticketing market.
Yeah.
But it's clearly had no effect whatsoever. It's pickpocketing.
Yeah,
it's licensed pickpocketing.
And what's more, it's a cartel, isn't it? Because there are many, many ticket outlets, and not a single one of them operates in a different, more buyer-friendly way, do they? They all club together and say, well, if we all conspire in this screwing of the punter, then all will be good. And so there's a cartel operating there, isn't there? Certainly.
Mm.
Yeah.
As I say, without tiring our listeners too much with this, I will just keep a sort of quiet eye on this, because it will be astonishing to see if these tickets actually are sold for the.
Well, I hope they're not. I hope they sit there and burn the hole in the pocket of whoever's punting them out, because it's an absolute disgrace. Interestingly, I've noticed this week, this might be a sort of, if you can't afford the £600 tickets, this might be an alternative you could go for, is that once the Beach Boy tour finishes, Mike Love has announced that he's going to tour South America as the Beach Boys, but without Al Jardine and Brian Wilson, because here's the reason for this is that I think in the 90s at some point Mike Love licensed the trading name Beach Boys from the Beach Boys lawyers, and he still has that license, and so it is only by the beneficence of Mike Love that this tour with Brian and Al is taking place, and he is perfectly at liberty afterwards to go off and tour as the Beach Boys on his own. That's exactly what he's doing, but Brian Wilson is absolutely dismayed and appalled by this, and he's gone on record to say so.
With the poor old Beach Boys, I think they're the primary example of now essentially being a product that just gets bandied about and caught in a legal minefield
absolutely
of nonsense.
I mean, if you were in, what should we say, Rio de Janeiro, and you saw the Beach Boys were playing in the local football stadium, and you thought, okay, I'll have a bit of that, and you bought a ticket, you got there, and it was only Mike Love, you wouldn't be best pleased, would you?
No, he would be the least of the troop that I would actually want to go, whether to Rio or across the road from my front door to see.
He's a spectacularly disliked gentleman, isn't he, really? He doesn't do himself any favours, really.
No, not at all. Now, this week, you, however, whilst I've been studying Beach Boys news, you've been viewing England from the air.
Yeah, the most extraordinary.
What have you been up
to? Well, the most extraordinary thing, last Sunday, and the weather on Saturday was pretty dire, so I figured this wouldn't be going ahead. But Sunday came round, and it was a fairly sunny-ish morning. I'll explain why the weather was relevant in a second. But we phoned a number to check this escapade was going to go ahead, and didn't get through the British disease. Nobody answered the phone. So we went up to a field sort of high above the Peak District, and we're delighted to find waiting for us in this field was a helicopter. Because for my wife's birthday last year, I bought her a flight in a helicopter. And as is usually the way with these things, you buy the ticket, the slip, but you know the event takes place at another time. And last Sunday was that appointed time. And unfortunately, there it was in the field, a helicopter. And we checked in, then went to the pub across the road, had a coffee, and then went, marched off and climbed into this helicopter. And it took us... right across, anybody knows the Peak District, right across Bakewell and Chatsworth and that sort of area, then in a big loop and back round to a place called Owler Bar, which is where we boarded. I'd never been in a helicopter before. Have you been in a helicopter?
I haven't, no.
No,
not at all.
It is extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. I can't recommend it highly enough. You would imagine, wouldn't you, that it was... you know, a bit roller coaster like, you know, a little.
I was going to say, I think, isn't it a bit wobbly?
Yeah, you'd think wobbly, bumpy, a bit queasy on the tummy, you know, a bit like, you know, when you're in an aeroplane, you hit some turbulence, something like. It's nothing like that at all. It is so smooth. The whole operation is very satisfyingly smooth. You just drift and glide everywhere. And so it's really, really easy to relax and concentrate on, you know, the landscape rushing beneath you, but of course you can slow. Unlike a plane, you can slow down. You can hover. You can dive right down. So we sort of dove onto this field, and I assume it's been done quite a few times because the sheep just glimpsed at us and carried on eating the grass as we sort of skimmed their backs. But and then you can soar right up to about 500 feet. But it's all so smooth. It's like when you dream, you know, when you have a dream that you're flying, and you have it's sort of very smooth and tranquil. And it's really like that. It's fantastically loud. You when you see helicopters on television, the people inside have got the headphones on, and I always assumed that was for, you know, ease of communication. But in actual fact, if you didn't have headphones on, it would be impossibly loud, absolutely phenomenally loud without the headphones. Special soundproof headphones, so you don't get that noise. You just get to, you know, speak to each other through the microphone. But that's what that's all about. But it's so enjoyable. We were only in the air about 20 minutes and then we landed. I could have spent, you know, the next 5 hours up there. How tremendous. If you had unlimited funds, then you can keep your fancy yacht. I would have a copter because it's great. It's just great.
What did Mrs. the Magna Shaw make of it, though, if it was for her birthday?
Yeah, well, it was one of her life's ambitions to go up in a helicopter.
Okay. Well, what did she make of it?
Well, when we went to check in, they said, oh, you're the first to check in, so what we can offer you is, for a very, very small sub fee, the co-pilot seats, you can sit up front, you know, with the pilot.
Oh.
So we said, okay, yeah, let's do that. So my wife went up front with the pilot, which was even more extraordinary. We took a little camcorder with us, and the footage from the front is even more impressive because you get that sort of panorama, don't you? You know, all around. Just absolutely extraordinarily good. I did a hot air balloon for my 40th birthday over Yorkshire, and that is amazing, an astonishing experience as well. But it's a little bit unnerving, I have to say, because you're just hanging in a basket at about 500 feet with no visible means of support and no motor. So you're a little bit nervous. In a helicopter, it is just beautiful. Nothing nerve-wracking at all. Just a, you know, really exciting and but strangely relaxing experience. I can't recommend it highly enough.
It's
it was really, really, really good. And I look forward to my next chance of going in a helicopter. Very hugely expensive machines to operate, spectacularly so. So the tickets don't come that cheap. But if you do get the chance, you know, if somebody offers to chopper you into Glastonbury next year, you know, then I would bite their hand off. It's fabulous, yeah.
Well, that's good. I was just worried when you said that you were going up into a helicopter. I thought that, you know, maybe you were recreating Apocalypse Now in the Peak District.
Well,
fortunately,
that really, really went through my mind. You know, there were three other people on board with us, and you can, you know, intercommunicate. The headphones are all linked up, and I did think about starting to say, "This is the end." But I didn't think anybody would get the joke, so I resisted.
No.
It was tempting, and I did think, "Oh yeah, we just need a blazing Vietnamese sunset behind me," and it would have been great. But honestly, if you get the chance, Really go for it. It's a superb experience.
Well, paled by that news, I noticed on Tuesday this week, headlines popping up, particularly on Twitter, saying Spice Girls reunited. And I thought, oh my goodness me, again, I thought, here they go again. And it turned out that they're actually not reuniting at all, but they were all together on Tuesday to plug a new West End musical based on their songs. It's called Viva Forever. And oddly, written the script of it's written by Jennifer Saunders.
Yes, I noticed that. Yes, yes.
Odd twist. I know Stephen Fry made his first million by writing Me and My Girl, so perhaps Jennifer Saunders is in for a bumper payday here. But this is an odd choice. Initially, I was going to say to you, this sounds very strange. Will this run at all in the West End? Mm-hmm. And then I just did a quick bit of research today, actually, and I've got in front of me a copy of today's Times newspaper. Mm-hmm. And I just looked at what's actually on in the theatres in the West End of London. London's glittering West End theatreland, yeah. Yes. 32 theatres. And if you'd have said how many musicals on, I'd have said four or five. There's 17.
Oh, yeah. Yes, yes.
I really didn't realise that, including, I must say, The Wizard of Oz with Des O'Connor. Palladium,
he's not playing Dorothy, I take it.
I dread to think. And Shrek the Musical, which, again, I have to say, I didn't realise had been made into musical. But, you know, this seems to be the sort of big idea of the day, doesn't it? Mm. I mean, We Will Rock You, the Queen thing's been going on forever at the Dominion. And that new Rock of Ages at the Shaftesbury Theatre, newish, several months now.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. That's taken off. But
I think they call them jukebox musicals, don't they? I think
apparently
And it is a high-risk business, I have to say. I mean, any theatre enterprise is a high-risk business. But these jukebox ones either tend to, you know, make phenomenal amounts of money forever and ever, like We Will Rock You. But I can think of others which have opened and closed with alarming rapidity. There was a Madness one called Art House, which crashed and burned. The Rod Stewart one didn't do the business either.
I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, I believe that's... I'm trying to think, was that called... No, it wasn't called Maggie May, was it? Don't know what it was called. Can't think. Oh, Tonight's the
Probably.
Night.
I was going to say Tonight's the Night. I was going to guess.
You would have been right. Yes. And I don't think that really caught fire.
Yeah.
So, they don't always catch light for some reason. And I don't know whether it's because there's the story is too flimsy, or people just don't really want to see those pop songs in a theatrical setting. I don't know, but they don't always fly. And obviously, it's not for want of the quality of the music, is it? Because you've got a ready-made set of hit songs there. So I don't know why they don't always capture the public's imagination. But of course, Mamma Mia is surely the most successful one.
Yes, absolutely. Must be over 10 years plus now, I thought. I just got this feeling, exactly what you say, it's kind of a hunch thing. You can't say which one's going to run and which one isn't,
really. No, you really can't.
I got a feeling this won't work. I like the Spice Girls. Mm-hmm. I've got a couple of their singles I really, really, you know, adored. But I just can't see this having that mass market, and particularly the international appeal that you want to pull tourists in. Like, We Will Rock You, and what was the other one we mentioned? Rock of Ages. Yeah. You know, you can imagine them appealing to an international audience. I'm not so sure about the Spice Girls.
No, although the Spice Girls, you know, were internationally successful, but then again, so were Take That, and their musical did about a week, I think.
Gosh, I tell you what, I'm out of touch with all these things. Yeah. I didn't even know there'd been a Take That.
Yeah, there was
musical.
A Take That one. Yes, yes. And I think the problem is that people want to see the stars behind the songs, don't they? It's a much lesser experience to go and see a cast singing the music of, you know, insert band name here, than it is to go and see that band. I mean, there's no comparison, is there? And
that's probably why I don't know about these, because, as you say, it is a vast difference. And I again wouldn't cross, and it's not a very big road that I live next to. It's a little tiny lane, and I wouldn't cross this little tiny lane that I live down to go and see any of these,
as you say,
jukebox musicals. Wouldn't it interest me at all? And I noticed that... Of course, cashing in quickly, that when Viva Forever opens, wherever it is, I've forgotten.
I think it's the Piccadilly, isn't it? Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It will coincide with the opening of The Bodyguard, a musical based on the Whitney Houston film, which is opening at the Adelphi.
Yeah, I'm guessing Kevin Costner won't be in that, and certainly Whitney Houston won't be. Good grief.
It'll then, by then, it will be a minority of theatres in the West End that are just showing sort of straightforward drama.
Oh, no, certainly. I think your starting point, if you're going to put on a show in the West End now, is that it's going to be a musical, if you really want to realise any money from it. And then probably a musical packed full of songs that people already know. I mean, that's how conservative it's all become, really. But, there are other successful. The Jersey Boys now just sprang into my mind. And that's been an enormous hit, hasn't it?
Very much so. And you see, you're right. Absolutely there. Because, as you mentioned before, it's hit and miss. Because if one had said, well, we're going to put on a musical based on the hits of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons from the 1960s.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think I would have invested in that.
And that versus one about, full of Take That songs, you think, well, I know which The Banker is there, but of course you'd be entirely wrong. Yeah, yeah. It is interesting. I don't know what the deciding factor is. The Thriller, the Michael Jackson one's done quite well as well. It's, especially since his death. I actually saw it before he died, when it was a bit of an afterthought. It was a provincial production, and it was like, well, we're all kind of over Michael Jackson now, so this is just a sort of little theatre filler. And then, of course, he died, and it shot into the West End, and it's still there, I think, probably.
It's still there at the Lyric.
Yeah,
yes.
There you go, yeah, yeah.
Yes, so apart from the huge behemoths of musical theatre like Les Miserables and I suppose Mamma Mia we count in now. It's just a stream of the Phantom of the Opera, of course, still running. There's Top Hat, Stomp, Singing in the Rain, Blood Brothers, Lion King, of course, we forget about that one.
Yeah.
Ghost the Musical, which again just sounds extraordinary.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have put that on, but it must have some form of success to be running at the Piccadilly.
Yes,
amazing.
Unfortunately, it's not seeing the Spice Girls act coming back together, other than for the photo call at the press conference earlier this week when they were all back together. But the last time they did get back together, the full lineup and toured, I went to see them in New Jersey. I saw them at the Penn Stadium in New Jersey, the Penn Arena New Jersey. Yeah, I did. Yeah, yeah. Always been my ambition to watch a big gig over in the States, particularly New York. I was only there for a week, and I think I was there for 4.5 days, and it was either Keith Urban, who's a sort of country hat act at Madison Square Gardens. That really wasn't going to light my candle. Or the Spice Girls in New Jersey. So there was no competition. So off I went to see them, and I had an absolute ball. I was almost certainly the oldest person there. And when all the teenage American girls who were sat around me heard me speaking to my wife, said, "Oh my God, you're English. You're English. Are you here with Beckham? Is Beckham here?" I said, absolutely no idea. But we had a great time here dancing with these young American girls and screaming and cheering alongside them. And great time was had by all. Interestingly, and I won't bang on about the Spice Girls gig, the only thing I would mention is that Posh was the only Spice Girl, I say Posh, Victoria, was the only Spice Girl who didn't do a solo set during the gig.
Yeah, I wonder why that may be.
Indeed, yeah.
He said, knowing that they both know the
answer. Yeah, it was very telling, though. And the other four, you know, fairly bravely, had the stage to themselves at one point or another throughout the gig, but not Victoria. No.
I did a similar thing, following exactly the same track as you. I was in the States thinking, I really want to go and see, a live band while I'm here, live concert experience. And I went to Milwaukee's Summerfest, and that was absolutely magnificent, right by the lake in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
And I saw the band America, the horse with them.
Yeah, yeah.
They were absolutely magnificent. But we stayed, honestly, we got there about midday, and the main band weren't appearing till I think about 11 o'clock at night.
Sure.
And we stayed dutifully to the end. It was Arrested Development. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. Now, don't tell me. They had a song called Tennessee, and they also had a song called Mr. Wendell.
Mr. Wendell, yeah, they did have, yeah. And they covered, what was it? It was a Sly Stone song, wasn't it? Every day, people every day.
Well, yeah, they switched it around, didn't they? People, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yes, they did. Yes, yeah. That was a number one, I think. People every day. That's a an interesting lineup there, though. Is a bit of sort of. Sort of rustic hip hop and sort of hippie folk there all at the same time.
Yeah, as I said, it was a festival, so there was all sorts of things going on during the day and all different acts all over the place. But it was a lovely experience, except, of course, being in the Midwest of America in the middle of the summer. It was just unbearably hot. Yes. With not a great deal of shade to be found by the shores of Lake Michigan, but it was a lovely experience.
Yeah, no, so absolutely.
It is great to go and see bands when you're abroad.
It is.
Different experience.
And all my trips to America since, I've missed by a couple of days shows I would love to have gone to. Mm-hmm. I think last year the B-52s did a free show in downtown Orlando, which I missed by about 4 days. It was after I'd come back. And then this year when I went to Kissimmee, Roger Waters was doing The Wall at a big sort of sports arena there, and I missed that by about 10 days. So,
of course, this is the other amazing thing, but particularly in America, but I found this in Spain as well, but particularly in America, you can go to a relatively, although Kissimmee isn't that, but you can go to a sort of relatively minor, small town in Midwest America or in Florida or something, and you suddenly find acts that we've more or less forgotten about turning up, playing a tour of the south of the states or the Midwest or whatever. I remember, again, when I was in Wisconsin, coming up against, what was Charlie Harper's band? UK Subs, wasn't it?
Yeah, the UK Subs, yeah.
Yeah, they were on tour in Kenosha, Wisconsin, when I was there.
Fantastic.
And I only found out because I went to get my hair cut, and the young lady cutting my hair said, oh, again, because the English thing, oh, we had one of your English punk bands in here last week.
Your English punk band.
One of your English, you know, again, assuming that we all know each other.
Yeah, that's right.
And it turned out to be Charlie Harper of the UK Subs, who were appearing in Kenosha, Wisconsin very week.
I wouldn't like to cut Charlie Harper's hair. You must need shears to do that. Yeah. He's a very curly-headed gentleman, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Some sort of chainsaw would be.
Yes, and I once was going to see Susie doing a solo set in an arts theatre in downtown New York, and my flight got in later than it was supposed to. And it's all right. You could pay on the door, so I didn't lose any money. But I was aware, as I was stood at the baggage carousel, that Susie was probably halfway through her set, so that didn't happen. But yeah, it's great going to gigs in the States. Yeah, fantastic.
Well, still on a sort of entertainment theme, and we were talking about drama a moment ago. This week also saw a peculiar piece of drama played out on BBC Two's Newsnight programme, where Jeremy Paxman interviewed Chloe Smith, Treasury Minister.
Yes.
And this was all to do with the fact that the increase on fuel duty had been postponed what appeared to be at the very last minute. And so Chloe Smith was put up to go and be interviewed. She's the economic secretary to the Treasury, to give her a full title, Conservative, of course, government minister. And
the youngest minister in the government, isn't she?
Yes, yeah. she is. She's only just. She's 30 years old last month.
Right.
So very very young in terms of parliamentary experience.
Yeah, we think Churchill became Prime Minister at 70. That's
And of course, it's also, I think, probably worth noting when we consider what happened next, that she actually came in on a by-election only in 2009, so she's been there less than 3 years. Sure. And her rise has been quite meteoric through to being in the heart of the government, as I say, economic secretary to the Treasury. You watched this, and I think to say that she was given a hard time by Jeremy Paxman would be an understatement.
It was. You know, when you watch these magnificent Attenborough documentaries, Life on whatever, and there's always, unless it's one of these Arctic ones, there's usually a scene where, from a helicopter, interestingly enough, you follow a cheetah racing across the Serengeti into a scattering herd of antelope or wildebeest, and it hones in on one of them and just chases it almost to the point of exhaustion, then leaps on it and just rips its throat out. This wasn't unlike that scene that we've seen on the wildlife documentaries. Chloe Smith was savaged in only just a metaphorical sense on Newsnight. My feeling towards politicians at the moment is such that where once upon a time I would wince a bit at the Paxman and to an extent the Humphrey style of stiletto interviewing, I really now am all for it. I'm afraid I just default to some kind of primitive self and cheer on the process of a politician being dismantled, because and I'm not just focusing on my bugbears, the Conservatives now. I am at that. I've probably come full circle to that sort of 20-year-old, you know, I would burn the lot of them sort of attitude now. I can no longer, you know, spot the nuances and subtleties in politics. I just really am pig sick of the flipping lot of them. I think, you know, they're just a massive liability. And so when we see a Paxman in full throttle, a part of me just wants to jump to my feet and cheer. But... what I would do is castigate her lords and masters for being so utterly yellow and frigid and cowardly, for want of a better word. In fact, that is probably the best word. But to put this rather softly spoken, politically naive young lady into the chair opposite Paxman at a time when they knew full well that they had fed the media enough ammunition to tear somebody to pieces. It was gutless, to say the least. And so my sympathies were with her because she had been royally had over by her bosses. But I can't find it within myself to castigate Paxman, because I think at this current moment in time, they deserve every strip you can tear off them.
Well, I am going to knock Paxman. I do disagree with you, although I fully understand, you know, why you say what you do. And I would say that my stance equally has got nothing to do with party lines. I would have felt the same, sure, if it had been a Labour or Liberal Democrat, anybody. I just thought it was an awful style of interviewing. Right. First of all, it reminded me, and I dislike it intensely when he does this as well on his other programme, University Challenge. I find it a form of bullying. You know, you sometimes get some poor hapless sap who's sat on the end from, you know, Magdalen College in University Challenge, and quick off the bus, okay, you'll start off at 10, tell me the composer of this music. Yep. Is it Mozart? And he says, Mozart! it's Stockhausen. Mozart. It's Stockhausen. And it makes the university student look like an absolute twerp and feel about an inch high. Yeah. And I loathe that. Yeah. I absolutely loathe that. He's got the answers in front of him. Yeah. He's in control of the programme. He's not under the stress of answering the questions. This is what I felt he was doing with Chloe Smith. I do agree with you that she appeared to be out of her depth. It was unfair to put her up. And she also did seem, this was not Paxman's fault, she did seem woefully unprepared in that she thought she'd be able to bluff an answer, which you can never do with someone like Paxman.
Well, interestingly enough, she had been on Channel 4 News earlier in the evening and had failed to bluff the exact same questions. So there's been a massive briefing failure there, because she made the same errors on Newsnight as she'd made 4 hours earlier on Channel 4 News.
Which is pretty unforgivable.
Yeah, really,
isn't it?
Yeah,
I think several people have said during the week, why didn't somebody take her aside between 7 p.m. and 10:30 Newsnight and actually say to her, look, you're going to get the same questions again. Let's think of a different way of framing what you're going to say. Right. But whatever party, as I say, here is a government minister. Now, I'm not saying we talked about this last week, that, you know, we, thank God, we're way past those days of deferential, you know, have you a statement for the country, ma'am? Yes, you know, yes. There wasn't any of that. But for Paxman, who is a journalist, an interviewer, mm-hmm. To say to a government minister, is this some kind of joke? Mm. And it, I'm not talking about the particular rudeness, but he also then followed that up. His next question after that was to say, you ever think you're incompetent?
Mm.
That's, I mean, well, that is rude, mm. but it's, to me, that's a form of bullying. And the reason that I dislike this so much is beyond what I would consider rudeness and bullying, which I do take very seriously, and I think that's what it was. I think it was essentially a, whatever he is, a 60-year-old man bullying a 30-year-old, albeit government minister. But it's the fact that when you take this line of saying, instead of asking a question or pressing her on the policy, and you say, is this some kind of joke, or do you ever think you're incompetent?
Mm.
It doesn't help us, the listener, one jot. All it does is make people either feel as I do, you know, one reacts to the circumstance. In other words, I reacted negatively in thinking, this is awful, he's bullying this young woman.
Mm.
You thought, you know, again, perfectly reasonable argument to take. You thought, you know, that, well, finally, here's a, you know, a politician getting their comeuppance. Either is a reasonable argument to take. But we learned nothing. We came from this interview knowing nothing. Now, I agree that part of that was because Chloe Smith felt that her stance had to be one of actually almost covering up
yeah.
what had happened
yeah.
in the previous 24 hours. But I don't think Paxman played the role that we, the viewer, would wish him to take, which is to get to the heart of the matter of what actually happened. He instead used his rather overbearing personality to make a youngish woman feel very uncomfortable indeed. And her body language, of course, gave that away more than anything. You know, she was desperately uncomfortable.
She was, yes. And she was being flayed alive. There's no doubt about it. I think, you know, had I delivered what Paxman delivered, I would have been quite uncomfortable after the programme as well as to what I had done. I think the difference between Newsnight and University Challenge is that the people who are held up to ridicule on University Challenge don't have any sway over the lives of millions of people, where government ministers do, and therefore they certainly need to be pulled up sharp. And if they appear to be anything other than competent and useful. But I think, yeah, I mean, Paxman has a shtick, and, you know, he is almost playing a character on Newsnight. I think he's also aware that really, as he winds towards retirement, what he really wants to do is you know, seal his reputation for the most formidable political interviewer, rather than, you know, play to his journalistic instincts of extracting information. So I think he is, you know, myth building in many ways. But all that said, anybody of any political vintage would realise what was going to happen to anybody from the government who was put up for interview on Newsnight that particular night. And those who would have ridden out the assault with a bit more robustness hid their lights under a bushel and allowed this Chloe Smith, who I don't know about you, but I had never heard of before, to take this appalling flak. So they, you know, they were the cowards. Would we be thinking the same had it been Osborne who'd had this unleashed on him? I would perhaps be even more delighted, but I certainly wouldn't change my view had it been Osborne.
I don't think I'd change my view if it was Osborne either, although to be fair, probably George Osborne or Mr Cameron would have had more confidence and would have been able to take a couple of breaths and answer back probably with give as good as they got, I imagine.
Mm.
So
mm.
it may not have panned out quite the same way. But had it done so, I, you know, would have still felt the same, that it would have, it didn't help us understand the situation any better, because there's a quite interesting story to be dug out there, which is that virtually everybody in the Ministry, Department of Transport, for a start, and certainly it seems in the Treasury, had no idea that this change was coming until some hours.
Which I think Paxman was, that's what Paxman was determined to expose, the notion that policy was being made on the hoof and not communicated correctly within government. And I think he wanted to, you know, shine a light on that. So
but Magnus, couldn't you say, if you were in that situation then, right, and Chloe Smith wasn't playing along and was doing this rather poor bluff situation, couldn't it be possible to say, well, I've asked you this question four times now, I don't intend to ask you a fifth time. You know, the fact that you're failing to answer this question, you know, the viewers can make up their own minds and read through what you're trying to say. Instead of saying, are you some sort of joke and are you incompetent?
I do agree with you, which is why I say I think Paxman is now in the process of myth building. And I think, you know, what Paxman probably took from that is, well, there's a clip that will be shown, you know, the day I retire or the day I shuffle off this mortal coil. Like, there's another notch in the bedpost, if you like. And I think, career wise, that's definitely what he's about now. He's building his myth as the most fearsome political interviewer of his generation, rather than, like I say, illuminating the viewer particularly. And I do agree with you on that, but I just, you know, my cynicism is now brimming over to the point where I find it very hard to care if a politician is made to look a bumbling fool at the moment, because that's what I feel they are. Whilst on a human level, I might feel a bit for Chloe Smith, on a political level, I think, well, you know, I'm glad I live in a country where, you know, authority figures can be exposed to this kind of white heat. But last week you used the phrase on the podcast, more heat than light, and this was an instance of that. Absolutely.
Well, now, speaking of excruciating television encounters, Alan Partridge, Steve Coogan's Alan Partridge, has been built on such a premise of us following Alan Partridge as he undergoes particularly, as I say, the word I think is excruciating circumstances. And on Monday, Sky Atlantic got their highest ever TV ratings.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It was only a 1% share, but nonetheless, 216,000 people for the new Alan Partridge show, Welcome to the Places of My Life, which was Partridge back, he liked to call it his coal face, Norfolk Digital Radio Station, which had some familiar edges to me, it must be said, but that's a story for another day. As he then gave us a tour of his view of his native town, Norwich. And I know you watched this. What did you make of Alan Partridge, Welcome to the Places of My Life?
I think Alan Partridge is one of the greatest comedic creations of perhaps the last 20 years. But with all great comedic creations, whether it's sort of Eric Morecambe's on-screen persona or Derek and Clive or you know, any of these cult comedy figures, they peak and they decline. And I think the Partridge character is probably in decline now. Originally sprang from the day-to-day show that Chris Morris did, where he was the sports reporter and was enjoyed so much that Coogan developed him into a character that was front and centre in various programmes. I think probably the best being I'm Alan Partridge, which was a fly on the wall series documenting the time he spent living in a travel tavern.
That was my favourite.
Well, it was impeccable, yes, absolutely great. And there was something about the situation he found himself in which just brought out the best in the character. And they always say about sitcoms, all the successful sitcoms, all the great sitcoms are about somebody or a group of people trapped. That is the essential ingredient to a great sitcom. If you look at Dad's Army, you know, you have Mannering, who is trapped in a fairly lowly position, which he really thinks is beneath him. You know, he really thinks he should be the Lord Chancellor, but actually he's the captain. He's not even a high ranking officer. He's the captain of a platoon. So he's trapped. If you look at Frasier, it's a man again who thinks that his position isn't quite as high as it ought to be. And, he really should be, you know, the 20th century's Sigmund Freud. Instead, he's a radio presenter. And he's trapped with his father, who he must now look after and doesn't really want to because it cramps his style, and so on and so forth. So
these are really good analogies. I think that's a really striking way of putting it. I agree.
So when Partridge is in... Well, thank you for that. But when Partridge is in the Travel Tavern, he is trapped. He has gone from a media career in London and a big house that he shared with his wife, who's run off with her aerobics instructor, and he no longer sees his son Fernando, and so on and so forth. So he is trapped in a situation which he thinks is beneath him, and I think there's that common theme running through all great comedy. With the new Partridge show, he isn't trapped. In the fantasy world of Partridge, he's started to regain some kind of traction on his career. And we're to imagine that, yes, he has a very lowly radio show on North Norfolk Digital, but we have to going along with the conceit, assume he's been given a TV series, which allows him to describe the town of his birth, which is Norwich. Unfortunately, because he's been released, the opportunities for that downtroddenness and sense of indignation aren't quite there as they were in the Travel Tavern. That said, there are some fantastic set pieces in this first episode. I really, really enjoyed the bit where they send up the sort of single presenter historical reconstruction programs that we see so much of on BBC Two, where they sort of act out different historical characters while stood in a room of something significant. So Partridge tries to do this in the council chamber of Norwich Council about a planning application. I think. I'll tell you what it is. It's
late night parking fees.
Yes, I thought that was great because it sent up a genre that I've not seen spoofed before, and he did it really tremendously well. There was another bit that made me fall off my chair laughing, and this might be just me being perverse, was where he'd showed us how to make a walking stick whilst out on a hike by taking a branch. There was just a delicious bit of slapstick involved, which Coogan did superbly. And the fact that he ended up with one stick that was too big and one stick that was too small just tickled me. I can't really explain why. It wasn't subtle at all, but it just really tickled me. So there's some great set pieces in this, but we have moved in the wrong direction from that beautiful situation where he was trapped in the Travel Tavern, and we probably won't get back there. But I enjoyed it because I just enjoy Partridge. Just really, really love that creation.
I so agree with you that it did suffer from a lack of place or context, like the Travel Tavern or the radio station. And when he did sort of position himself somewhere, it was in Thetford Forest, which he described as home to dogging and suicide. and that was it. As you said, there were some really great one-liners in it, as he stood there imagining the sheep that were there as people who had wronged him in the past. The more I learn about Hitler, the less I like him.
Yeah, and there's a lovely scene where they played Deutschland über alles, or one of the, you know, the big Nazi jingoistic songs, whilst his eyes sort of narrowed and he drifted off into a fascist fantasy, which I quite enjoyed as well. I always sort of scratch my head and wince a bit when you suggest we review comedy, because I think our tastes in comedy are quite different. So did this come anywhere close to your field of affection?
Only, as I say, the one-liners. I felt exactly the same as you, that really here was an idea on its way down again. I mean, I must admit, I've loved the whole journey with Partridge, and you know, I even have a box set of his work, so that's big for me to you know, because I'm often very critical of particularly British comedy, but I thought this was absolutely, you know, superb concept, and it's been brilliant all through the years. And I particularly love the travel tavern days. And I even liked, did you remember it came, he came back last year and did some little web-only cameos, I think, sponsored by Foster's Lager.
Right. Yeah.
And I quite enjoyed those, although, again, they weren't... Again, that was just teetering over the edge. Now I think he's gone over the edge. It's not impossible that the Alan Partridge character could still have a journey to travel, could still have legs, but I just felt that this particular episode that we saw, the first return, it didn't seem to have a great deal of effort into it. It seemed like there had been the one-liners were great. Mm. I'll tell you what exemplified that for me, and it's something you didn't mention, was that we spent forever, just so too long, in the Range Rover with him out on a test drive.
Yeah, that didn't really...
And that just dragged on. There was no humour in it.
No, I'm not sure what they were trying to achieve there. It didn't really come off. No, I agree with that. And yeah, it had faults like that. There was a really nice touch in the writing. There was a very, very subtle subplot. When he's at the radio station, he opens a letter and you just see on the top the NHS logo.
Oh, yes.
And then in the Range Rover, he throws a massive strop and says he no longer wants to test it off road. And then gets the documentary car to stop at the hospital. So he's obviously had a test for something, hasn't he? And when he comes out, he's bought everybody chalk ices because obviously it's come out right. But I like the way that that was so enormously underplayed that it was only on reflection, making a cup of tea once I'd watched it, I thought, oh, hold on. There was, you know, all those events that I've mentioned all tied together to create a very subtle subplot. That was really nicely done. I thought it was very good.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Sky Atlantic, if you have access to it, are going Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge crazy at the moment.
Okay.
You can watch Welcome to the Places of My Life is being rerun constantly. So if you did miss it first time around, you can watch it again. Yeah. Also, they're going to be running an interview. Their regular book review program, Open Books with Martin Bryce. Alan Partridge is going to be coming on to talk about
that's very great.
His books. I really want to see that.
I mean, I like it when you take a fictional comic character and you know, just for a very short period of time, drop them into the real world and see what happens. I think that's always, it doesn't always work. I mean, I remember Ali G interviewing Victoria and David Beckham on Comic Relief, and it didn't work at all. It needed the script, and it didn't have the script. But I think Coogan can pull that off. That should be, I'd love to see Partridge doing a book review. That would be
fantastic. I'm looking forward to it because in the preview about the Open Books interview with Martin Bryce, they say Alan is only too keen to share the secrets of his craft, revealing details of his grueling writing regime. 1,500 words per day, usually with a bowl of hard-boiled eggs for sustenance. So I think that gives us a clue to what will be coming up in the next few days on Sky Atlantic. Also, they're running Mid-Morning Matters,
which was the special thing. Edition,
which was the Foster's thing. Yeah. And they're running that on Sky Atlantic too. And as I say, it's no point me giving you dates and times because basically they're constantly rerunning it.
Yeah, brilliant. No, really good. I will tend to agree with you in that I hope that Coogan and Iannucci, who does a lot of the writing with Steve Coogan, are brave enough to realise when enough's enough. Because I've heard both Coogan and Iannucci announce there would be no more Partridge several times over the last few years, and they come back to it, which is fair enough, but I hope they'll be brave enough at some point to say, you know, this is an ever-decreasing circle here and we need to move on, because it would be a shame if we got some really poor material from such a brilliant comic character.
Agreed. Now, just before we move on to your mystical pretend iPod.
So it's suddenly become mystical.
Mystical. I don't know why I said that. Mystical, magical iPod. I think today is, we're recording this Thursday the 28th of June. Yes. 2 hours before we open the microphones, Zowie Bowie has announced his engagement to Rodine.
Oh, okay.
So now of course called Duncan Jones. Yes. And I just think we should just pause a moment to congratulate the lovely couple. Yeah. Who ever thought we would come to a day we would live so long that Zowie Bowie,
now married,
Duncan
yeah.
Jones, is getting married to Rodine Ronquillo. Yeah.
And I would congratulate him on his debut movie, Moon, which I thought was fabulous. I really, really liked that as well. So, Duncan Jones, Zowie Bowie, great. Getting married. Yeah. Super. Yeah.
Getting married. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I can remember when he was born.
That's exactly.
Why
yeah, yeah. I wonder if Roland Bolan will be the best man.
Gosh, yes, wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it?
Roland Bolan and Zowie Bowie. Yeah, exactly. Right, so time indeed for you to reveal your choice for your pretend... What did we call it in the early days?
It was a virtual iPod. And
virtual iPod.
That was far too pretentious and it became a pretend iPod.
The pretend iPod.
Now it's a mystical iPod. So.
Mystical, magical iPod.
Okay, well, think of Adam and the Ants and a number of records will spring to mind. Probably first and foremost would be Stand and Deliver.
Stand and Deliver, yeah.
Ant Music, maybe.
Indeed,
Ant Music. Yeah.
For each one that you mention, I'll sing a little line from it. No, I won't. Okay. Don't worry, I won't. People will be turning off.
I would throw you something difficult like Whip in My Valise or something. And fine records they all were, Dog Eat Dog and Kings of the Wild Frontier, all great records. But long before the Pirate Stripe and the Cavalry Jacket and the plaits and the leather trousers, although possibly the leather trousers run through the whole thing, Adam and the Ants were a sort of obscure punk band, and never quite aligned with the politics of the Clash. Certainly not aligned politically with the Clash at all. Not as outwardly aggressive and snarling as the Pistols, doing something quite different, a bit sexual and very arty, and more sort of akin to Velvet Underground than certainly the Cockney Rejects or Sham 69. And their first single was one that still completely confuses me. It's called Young Parisians, which is seems like a bit of a send-up of
Young Parisians are so French.
Yes, it's sort of played on an accordion, and it's all very odd, and it never really convinced me at all. However, let's just come to the second ever Adam and the Ants single. At the time when Ants was spelt with a Z, you can draw a very firm line between the two eras of Adam and the Ants. The less successful but more interesting era, when they spelt the Ants with a Z, and then the more commercial and enormously popular era when they spelt Ants with an S. Anyway, this is Ants with a Z. It's the second single, and it was called Xerox. They had to spell it with a Z whilst we're on about spelling things with a Z, because Xerox with an X was a trademark. And interestingly enough, the whole song is about who owns the rights to creative endeavours and trademarks and brand names. It seems, and I've never been able to get to the bottom of this story, that Adam is heartily cheesed off with somebody who's ripped a song off from him. You might be able to enlighten me, you may not. It doesn't really matter, because it's just whilst the punks were all very angry about all sorts of things, about the Queen and about the army and about, you know, racism and everything, I always thought it was quite refreshing that at least one of the punks was very upset and angry about the subtleties of trademark legislation. And I thought it was always really quite nice. And then, you know, this was quite typical of Adam at the time to be totally left field. But all that aside, I mean, the subject matter is never enough to guarantee a song is going to be absolutely wonderful. It's more importantly, is this is just a fantastically crafted piece of art pop rock, really. It's got an absolute killer hook that runs all the way through it. I think Matthew Ashman was his guitarist at the time, went on to be guitarist in Bow Wow Wow. He really, really sort of layers all this scratchy guitar that runs all the way through it. And it's just very insistent. It's interesting that when he went on to be Kings of the Wild Frontier and Stand and Deliver and everything, insistency was the sort of common theme through Adam and the Ants songs. Yeah, he really liked to carry on sort of drumming away at a particular riff or a pattern. And he does this in Xerox, but out of everything Adam and the Ants ever released, and there's some wonderful stuff, I think Xerox, for me, stands head and shoulders above the rest of them. It's idiosyncratic, couldn't be nobody else but Adam Ant. His vocal is terrific, and he kept that vocal style all the way through the Ant's career. But this is the first time we really encounter it, because Young Parisians is done in this sort of fake French thing, which, as I've said, I've never really got to grips with. So this is the first time we hear Adam full throttle in that wailing vocal style of his. And it just struck me as being utterly different from all the other punk records around at the time, and made me interested in the band, which continued all the way through to when they split up. I was always interested in Adam and the Ants. Even retained an interest in Adam when he went solo, and certainly even when he was doing rubbish like Ant Rap, I still thought he was an interesting character. And as he remains today, sadly not always terribly well, but at the moment doing quite well and touring with a new band. But whatever he does, I shall always associate him with the terrific record that is Xerox by Adam and the Ants.
Nice. Yes. Good choice. I still love Adam today, like yourself. It's, how life is enriched with characters like Adam Ant yes. in it, it has to be said. It probably was. I imagine it was Matthew Ashman, as you said, before he went on to Bow Wow Wow. Mm. But what that guitar riff reminds me of, always, every time I hear Xerox, I picture, in my mind, I see a steam train chugging along, because that's what it evokes to me. That it's just like you said, that sort of driving, repetitive sound, which is great.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have a kind of vision, a kind of video running through my head of a train just going chuff 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 all the way through, which mirrors the guitar work.
It's great to say that I saw Bow Wow Wow in Derby many years ago with Matthew Ashman on guitar, and one of his sort of flourishes was to mask off all the strings, deaden all the strings on. And he played one of these huge Gretsch semi-acoustic, white Gretsch semi-acoustic guitars, and to mask off all the strings so they're all dead, and use it as a percussion instrument, just run his plectrum over the strings rhythmically, and the pickup would give you a sort of feel. And there you go. And that gives you that sort of steam train sound. So perhaps he's doing a bit of that way back on Xerox. But Matthew Ashman no longer with us, I think I'm right in saying.
I think you're right. Yeah. I think he died rather young.
Yeah, he did bury
We always like to end on a downer, don't we?
I'm afraid so, yes.
Yes,
and one of the first people I ever saw with a Mohican, actually, Matthew Ashman. Isn't it?
Again, yes, very striking looking.
Yeah, he was, and he was great on stage as well. So, there he was with Adam on Xerox, and there is a re-recorded version as well that they rushed out to fulfill a contract. They had a deal at the time with Do It Records, who released all the early Ant stuff, and they owed Do It one more single before they moved to a major label after the massive success that they had with Kings of the Wild Frontier, and they chose to re-record Xerox. And they're both good versions. I would go for the original, but I'm really not that picky. The re-recorded one's pretty good as well. So.
Mm. So another week we must talk all about the Adam and the Ants, Malcolm McLaren, Bow Wow Wow.
All
of that syndrome. There's a tale there.
Yeah, brings in Boy George and John Moss and all sorts of people with it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. It ends up with 15-year-old
Annabella.
Annabella, yes, indeed. Now, what would that have been, 78? 79?
Yeah, 79, I think. Yeah, 79. Well, Do It Wears White Socks was 79, and Xerox just preceded that, yeah.
Only 4 years then before that, but an absolute world apart. Amazing now to think in retrospect, it's 3 or 4 years separating these ages of music. I'm going to take you back to 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And the agency for which I worked was responsible for booking out a tour package for Warner Brothers.
Yes.
And the idea was to introduce British audiences to Little Feat.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers acts. Little Feat, Graham Central Station, Tower of Power, Montrose.
Grand Funk Railroad.
No. Graham Central Station.
Well, I kind of associate Grand Funk Railroad with that sort of era as well, don't you? No.
Well, they were of that era, but they weren't on this package.
No, of course they were. No,
Brothers were sending over in 1975.
Guessing,
Grand Funk Railroad. Grand Funk Railroad, the first, with the headline act of the first proper gig I ever went to.
There you go.
Which was, going off at a tangent, in Hyde Park, 1971, free concert, Hyde Park.
Yeah.
top of the bill, Grand Funk Railroad. Yeah. Didn't go to see them. Went to see second on the bill, Humble Pie.
Grand Funk Railroad, of all things.
And third on the bill, there were only three acts. Yeah. Third on the bill, the wonderful, and I fell in love with them. I went to see Humble Pie, but fell in love with Heads, Hands and Feet.
Right, okay.
That's a story for another day. Heads, Hands and Feet featuring in the band, Chaz Hodges, later to be Chaz and Dave. Chaz Hodges.
And Heads, Hands and Feet always sounded to me like a 1970s lunchtime children's show. Really,
Heads, knees and toes. Shoulders, knees and toes. Heads, Hands and Feet, a great band. They may even pick them for the mythical, magical.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, I don't really know them except by name, so that would be interesting. But anyway, back to the subject.
Chas Hodges and Albert Lee in Heads and Feet. Anyway, back to 1975. Warner Brothers tour, booking it out, and I'd say Little V, Graham Central Station, Tower Power Montrose, and the Doobie Brothers.
Ah.
And this is the act that I'm going to be talking about here. Now, we part of this, it's a package tour, as I say, and we booked three nights and an afternoon. Can you imagine? We did it. There was an afternoon matinee with Little Feet at the Rainbow Theatre and the Doobie Brothers in January 1975. So we booked three nights at the Rainbow Theatre in the afternoon. And sorry, everybody up in the Northwest, but we booked a warm-up gig at the Free Trade Hall in Manchester as well for them to get used to English conditions before they came to do the important run at the Rainbow Theatre. So, on the 16th of January, we had them at the Free Trade Hall, Doobie Brothers, in Manchester. Yeah. And they had to get to London for the next night. We didn't give them any time off at all. The next night, they were at the Rainbow Theatre. Now, crucially, and almost disastrously, some of the entourage, including some of the band, the Doobie Brothers, decided to drive themselves from Manchester to London. And again, these are the days, I'm fairly sure they didn't have international driving licenses, but again, these days you just went and hired a car. Nobody asked any questions. You just got it. In the offices in London in the early afternoon, and we have to remember that in 1975, no mobile phones, no sat navs. Early afternoon with their big gig coming up at the Rainbow Theatre in the evening. I got a phone call, a reverse charge phone call. I don't even know if you can still make those. Younger people may not know what I'm talking about. Anyway, reverse charge phone call from a shop. And a woman came on talking to me, and I could hear her in the background talking to a man with an American accent. Yeah. And she was saying, okay, you can speak to him now. And on comes this rich American accent, and I suppose I'd better not try and mimic the accent, but it is important for this line because he says, hey, how do we get to London from Goldchester? We're in Goldchester, and we would need to get to London. So I'm thinking, Goldchester? Well, where the hell are you? And, you know, Goldchester? And this conversation as it went on for a few more exchanges until I could hear the shopkeeper in the background saying, Gloucester! tell him you're in Gloucester, not Goldchester. This Goldchester. Is Gloucester. You say Goldchester. We're last in Goldchester. So here we have the Doobie Brothers stranded in Gloucester. So I was scrambling for the office map of Britain. And again, you have very rudimentary motorways relationships even in the 1970s. And I was finding myself giving instructions to a member of the Doobie Brothers of how to get to London from Gloucester, not Goldchester, in time for the gig at the Rainbow Theatre that very evening. And I always remember my last words before, I imagine the shopkeeper got fed up and took the phone off him. I remember saying, call me again from Slough. I always remember saying that to him, thinking that would be a good sort of stopping point.
Yeah, and I'm guessing Michael McDonald's knowledge of the M4 was limited, to say the least.
I think all American visitors... was limited, but I did indeed. I remember saying to them, get on the M4 and when you get to Slough, tell me where you are.
But you know, on reflection, that you and these very, very easy in retrospect, what you should have said is, have you considered taking the long train running, Michael?
Oh, Hall. Oh, my giddy aunt. What a cracker. If only I had thought that.
Oh, yes.
I may have ended up with a punched nose when...
when he got back from Goldchester, yeah.
So anyway, somehow, to cut this incredibly long story short, and heaven knows how, they did actually make it to the Rainbow Theatre with, and I do mean minutes to spare. They weren't there for the sound check. That all went on without them. At this time, to get to my choice for the jukebox, otherwise we're going to be here till Christmas.
A jukebox now, notice, listeners.
It's iPod. iPod, sorry. Mythical, magical iPod jukebox. Yeah. That's because we were talking about jukebox musicals earlier. I had jukebox in my brain.
Unplug the jukebox and do
the favour and music. Single. That the Doobie Brothers released to coincide with their UK dates. We're getting there. Though typically, this is just typical of Britain, isn't it? Yeah. This tour was in January. They actually released the track in May of 1975 to coincide with their tour.
Right.
But amazingly, it still became something of a hit. Anyway, this particular song, which we'll get there in the end, always reminds me of Goldchester. Take Me in Your Arms is the song. It's a wonderful rock crossover of a Motown song, of all things.
Oh, yeah.
Holland Dozier Holland writing team. Straightforward shot, really, at having a hit record. And it went full of exquisite orchestration, mixed with the Doobie Brothers at their exuberant best, smooth Ted Templeman production. It's chock full of 1975, which for me was warm, fun and naive. I was a very naive young...
Not as naive as the Doobies, it would seem.
Not as naive as Doobie Brothers on the M4, heading from Goldchester to the Rainbow Theatre. 3:42 of great cultured pop. Take Me in Your Arms and Rock Me a Little While reached number 11 in the Billboard Hot 100. Over here, a peak of number 29 in the UK in June 1975. So you can see it was 6 months after it was supposed to coincide with their tour. The Doobie Brothers, Take Me in Your Arms.
Ah, good call. Interesting with the Doobie Brothers, wasn't it? Because they, they were a good time band, weren't they? But they were very, they were quite rocky, upbeat, funky. And then when Michael McDonald went solo, he kind of went for these big soul ballads, didn't he? He's Michael McDonald's solo stuff never sounds like the Doobie Brothers, does it?
No, not at all. Well, he came in quite late, you know. Again,
But
he wasn't part of the band back in this sort of 75 era. They had Jeff Skunk Baxter.
Who could forget?
Jeff Skunk Baxter, as I live and breathe here, I promise you that was his name. From Steely Dan.
Yeah.
And he'd come over, he'd transferred in a free transfer to Doobie Brothers. Michael McDonald only came in much later on when, again, their star had waned quite considerably.
Yeah.
Not long. I think Take Me in Your Arms may have been a step too far.
Yeah.
So I think their popularity then wins. And then he cropped up. Michael McDonald popped in. Oh, must have been late 70s, early 80s when they had What a Fool Believes.
Yeah, What a Fool Believes. Yeah. I don't think I realised that. I always assumed he was somewhere in the Doobie Brothers mix all along. Right. Okay.
He was never part of the oeuvre until...
Right. That explains a lot then. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, terrific.
So, you know, if ever you're on the M4 and you see a bunch of guys... all crammed into a very small van. May you ever remember that in 1975, an absolute lifetime ago.
Well, there'll be
so a bunch of lads trying to get to the Rainbow Theatre from the talking about mythical towns, the mythical town of Goldchester.
Goldchester, yeah. Well, I was going to say, before we leave the podcast for this week, perhaps we should say hello to my brother and sister-in-law who live in Goldchester. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. So, well, thank you for that. It's a good choice. We'll make sure that goes up on the mythical, invisible, virtual iPod jukebox. And we'll enjoy listening to it alongside Ab and the Ants and their song Xerox. And that's it for another week. Thank you very much, Terence. We'll see you back around about the same time for more fun and jollity. We'll do another podcast next week. And thank you very much to you for listening at home. We do appreciate it. And we look forward to you joining us around about the same time again. Bye bye.
To a Dacom Shore Media Production.
Do you ever wake up in the morning and think, my God, what am I going to be told today?
I wake up in the morning and know actually that some of my constituents will really value not having to pay that little bit more on fuel prices come August, because the cost of living is pretty tight at the moment, and everybody does know that. I do think this move today is valuable. It's not just a Westminster Village story, Jeremy. It's real money in real people's pockets.
Oh, we all understand that.
Good.
You ever think you're incompetent?
I think it's valuable to help real people in this way, and I do think that is valued by people who drive.
Okay, Chloe Smith, thank you.